Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we're going to check in with Kelly Shortridge, and the topic is zombies. Not the botnet kind, the heavily VC-backed kind. A recent report from the Reuters news agency highlighted the amount of VC pouring into the so-called cyber industry versus the amount of money actually coming out of it in the form of profitable exits. Well, they don't quite match up. The report says the industry is filling up with so-called zombie companies. They'll never exit, but they're not going to completely die either. And as it turns out, Kelly recently did a presentation on precisely this topic. So in this week's feature, we'll get her take on why this is happening and what's likely to change. The TLDR is something we'll have to give in the next couple of years, and it's probably going to be pretty ugly. In this week's sponsor interview, we chat with Jordan Wright of Duo Security. Jordan has done some research into phishing kits. And while phishing kits aren't the sexiest topic, the team at Duo has actually done some pretty comprehensive research here. They looked at thousands of kits and pulled out some pretty interesting stats. We'll talk to him about that and also about the likelihood that U2F-enabling hardware will soon be baked into consumer devices. That could really change things in years to come. All that is coming up later, but first up, it's time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, it's been a cracking week for security news, and probably the story making the biggest impact this week is the so-called Strava heat map. And
yeah, it's getting a lot of coverage in mainstream press as well as across the, you know, the security Twitters and things. This is a company that's like a sort of social networking, like data aggregate-y, social networky sort of thing for wearable fitness technology people. So Fitbits and whatever, and it collects a bunch of data. Anyway, they published a data set which has essentially every piece of data from someone, you know, bicycling or walking or whatever, wearing a device that's connected to the social network. And they published it all on the internet with maps and things, so you can see where people have been doing things, which is fine, you know, if you live in San Francisco or something. But yeah, turns out if you're posted in a, you know, secret military base in Afghanistan somewhere, yeah, it's a bit of a giveaway. Turns out it's a really great way to spot first world people in third world countries. And yeah, the people have been mining it for all sorts of interesting bits and pieces, various interesting places, trying to spot the CIA and the, you know, army and whoever else with the data, which, yeah, interesting conversation about metadata and OPSEC.
It sure is. And I got to say, though, like, I think some of the reaction to this has been maybe a little bit off target, right? Because, like, with a lot of these military bases, like, people are like, look, people have been jogging around Pine Gap, which is a, you know, secretive facility here in Australia that everybody knows exists, right? So in that sense, maybe some of the reactions have been a bit strange. But still, I think the key thing with this story is it's impossible to know what the damage is, right? And that's OSINT in a nutshell. Okay, so it might not be a big deal if you say, oh, okay, here's a military base in Afghanistan, but what about a CIA safe house in Mogadishu, right? Like, that's probably not info you want out there.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And that's the thing with OSINT, right, is combining a bunch of data from a bunch of different sources which are not apparent to the people whose data, you know, the people, when you see one data set, it may not be apparent what uses that data has for other things. And I guess in the case of physical location data, we can kind of infer bits about that, like sort of intuitively without really having to think about it. But when you see people who are really talented at OSINT and see how they join things together, and some of the, you know, the things that they can pull out are really amazing from, and, you know, not at all intuitive. And so, yeah, you don't really know how this kind of data can be combined with other stuff and what you can draw from it. So, yeah, it's been a good week, I think, to have this discussion out there in the, you know, in the wider sphere than just the, you know, InfoSec ranting on Twitter.
Well, and Wired UK reports that actually it's not too hard to de-anonymize this data, which is, you know, that's a, that that really kicks it up into a much more serious realm.
Well, yeah, and also be able to, there was another example I read somewhere of, you know, taking places where you know something, like an example was, I think, a missile base somewhere, seeing staff from one of them go home and then watching where else they go and finding other facilities you didn't know about based on, you know, not necessarily a person, but a role or, you know, something that they're involved in. So, yeah, there's a bunch of kind of de-anonymization other than just identity, I guess, that you can do with it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, they did manage to pull out names because people put their, you know, their jogging stats on leaderboards and things like that. So it is, impact unknown, I guess, is the thing. And that's, you know, when we start talking about huge amounts of data in aggregate, even if it's not identifying, you know, the impact can be quite severe. And, you know, the extent to which it can be de-anonymized is unclear. And yeah, basically can open worms everywhere. Very fun story. Adam, just after we published last week's show, some news broke that the Dutch government had apparently owned Cozy Bear pretty hard over a period of years and was able to warn the United States about attacks against the DNC. This is a very interesting story. I mean, because the extent of ownage here is pretty severe. We should point out too that Cozy Bear is the APT group that is believed to be responsible for fairly typical espionage and intelligence collection. It's Fancy Bear, who are the Guccifer 2.0 norm-breaking, crazy, stab you in the face hackers that are alleged to have dumped email to WikiLeaks. So different group, but it's still an interesting story.
Yeah, it is. And we don't often see, you know, detailed insights to, you know, exactly what nation states are doing to each other's hacking apparatus. In this particular case, apparently, amongst other things, the Dutch owned the surveillance CCTV cameras. I guess closed circuit's kind of a misnomer these days. They owned the IP cameras in the foyer of the office and were able to see all the Cozy Bear, you know, people kind of coming and going and, you know, pin real identities to the people actually doing some of this hacking, which is, you know, the sort of thing you would expect.
Well, we've heard of GCHQ doing exactly the same thing to various Russian groups. That was more of a rumor than, you know, comprehensive reporting like this, but it seems to be a fairly standard trick in the toolbox these days for SIG agencies running these sort of ops.
Well, I know I've owned IP cameras, you know, they're really helpful. You can see people typing in creds and all sorts of good stuff. So yeah, it makes sense to do it. But yeah, it's kind of nice to see the, you know, the nitty gritty details for those of us that, you know, aren't Intel community and like to, you know, like to imagine what they're up to, but don't get to see the details. So yeah, it's pretty fun stuff. But yeah, you know, the fact that this is leaking out, I think, perhaps is more interesting, as it does really point to a deterioration in relationships, that this is kind of leaking out because it's embarrassing for some of the people involved and, you know, not good for sources and methods and all that kind of thing. So, yeah, what it says about the relationship between the Dutch and the Americans, you know, in the fallout from this is, yeah, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, they were kicked out of that network a while ago, right? So they haven't. I don't know that they burned this op that way through this leak. It's long gone. But yeah, it is an interesting insight and a reminder to people who are very skeptical about confident attribution that sometimes what that means is they've got video of the people coming and going from work and actually typing the commands and seeing them pop up at the other end. So there you go. Some really interesting news out of the United States here. There's a memo, I think, from the National Security Council that was published by Axios over the week saying that there's a proposal within the United States that they will nationalize the 5G network. I actually read the memo, most of it, and it looks like their primary concern is locking Huawei and ZTE out of a 5G build, which makes you wonder why they just don't do that through regulation.
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. And I imagine that's probably what will actually happen. I mean, there's been some kind of, I guess, walking back of this particular memo as a, you know, an early draft that's not representative of what they actually ended up, you know, talking about more seriously. Because, yeah, the idea of them, you know, not giving out spectrum and then building the network themselves, you know, just kind of, you can imagine that getting, you know, cocked
socialism
up. Well, that, of course, that's too. You know, trusting the, you know, the government to be able to, you know, build a complex technology stack and not just get ripped off in the marketplace by whoever they pay to do it. You know, that doesn't, you know, private sector might get ripped off a little less, but yeah, you do wonder whether the more sensible outcome is, as you say, to just kind of regulate it in the kind of same ways that we've seen Australia do with, you know, blocking Huawei from being involved in the national broadband network there.
Yeah, well, and denying, you know, requests to land fiber that's connected to Huawei gear in other countries, as we saw with the Solomon Islands quite recently, right? So, Australia is like, no Huawei on our backbones, please.
Although I guess ZTE certainly is everywhere on the client side. I mean, you see ZTE devices, you know, USB modems and that kind of thing, cell modems all over the place in Australia. So didn't do a very good job on the other end, that end of it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you sort of wonder if that tide's changing as well, because we saw a deal between AT&T and I think it was Huawei, actually, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was one with AT&T, Huawei, and I think also Verizon.
And that was around devices, right? Not so much around the network.
Yeah,
so
I think that was on devices.
Yeah, this balkanization thing is kind of accelerating. It's a real thing. You know, you look at Kaspersky and stuff. But I guess we've been on this merry-go-round before here in Australia, so it's less. It's less of a news story, I think, for us here, given all of the drama with Huawei, which was like, what, eight years ago or something. But interesting nonetheless. So, one listener actually suggested something interesting on Twitter, which is maybe the reason they don't want to do it via regulation is because the government simultaneously wants to gut the regulatory powers of the FCC.
Well, that's entirely plausible given the way the American government rolls these days.
Yeah, crazy times. Microsoft has disabled Intel Spectre fixes. I mean, we spoke about how the patches were not going so well on last week's show, but now Microsoft's been forced to step in and just sort of say, no, stop.
Yeah, well, certainly Microsoft is in a good position, I guess, to be able to do something about this, you know, rather than relying on all the OEMs and other things. So, yeah, I guess it's not a surprising follow-up to the story last week. But, yeah, we have rather made a mess as an industry of this whole, you know, of the response to this particular bug. Although I guess it is complicated, right? Rushing out microcode fixes and all that kind of thing that work everywhere.
Yeah, it belongs heavily in the realm of being unpredictable. Meltdown and Spectre silicon fixes are coming in 2018, this year, according to this piece in Ars Technica, Adam.
Yeah, I guess Intel been rushing, rushing to make whatever changes need to be made to stuff that's in the kind of in the planned roadmap for this year and onwards. Obviously, we have to wait and see what the actual hardware looks like, whether it's they've just kind of implemented the same things that they've been microcode patching into the older ones, or where they actually have got some, you know, change in how, say, speculative execution does work. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll wait and see.
Yeah, look, between the burn cycles and the re-engineering cost, I think these were, you know, I said it at the time when it first broke, this is the most expensive security bug we've seen, and certainly NotPetya was the most expensive attack we've seen. So it's been a year of firsts the last 12 months or so. Very interesting. Now, Alphabet, the parent company of Google, has launched a security startup, which is very interesting. I called it a meteor aimed at Planet Threat Intel, which Brian Krebs actually pinched and used as a headline, which is great. But he also said nice things about the podcast and his story. But this is thank you, Brian. But this is I suspect this is going to be a big deal because Google, you know, really does know security, and now they're going to start offering some of that goodness to the outside world. What a great idea.
Well, yeah, exactly. We don't really know what they're going to do yet. I guess we'll find that out at some point in the near future. But yeah, I mean, Google is nothing if not, you know, supremely competent in, you know, by comparison to everybody else in the security industry. So yeah, the idea that they're going to show up and do something useful with that knowledge that we can, you know, purchase, presumably. That's pretty interesting. We have to wait and see what they're going to offer because, yeah, I mean, they know what they're doing. And yeah, I'm interested to hear what they got to say.
I didn't know about this announcement specifically, but I knew something was coming because one of the CMOs that I deal with, actually, from a sponsor, a risky business sponsor, actually moved to Google a while back. And I thought, why do they need a like enterprise InfoSec marketing manager? This is interesting. And then we actually got on the line and he said, yeah, look, I want to book a soapbox. So I should disclose that too. There is going to be a commercial arrangement there, but they booked a soapbox to speak about some unspecified announcement, which I actually mentioned in the show, I think last week or the week before. So I think that's scheduled for March. So we're going to have a good 45-minute chat with Google and find out, you know, what it's all about. But, yeah, very interesting development anyway. I mean, the visibility they have, their internal tooling, you know, I want to see as much of that available to the general population as possible. We're not going to dwell too much on cryptocurrency this week, but there has been $400 million worth of ownage over the last week, Adam, which is, well, quite a lot of money.
Yeah, someone nicked, 500 million ZEM, some other, you know, cryptocurrency I've never heard of and probably will never hear of again, from the biggest exchange in Japan. It's not clear how it got nicked, but yeah, apparently they're going to cover the losses, Lord knows with what, but, you know, $500 million ain't bad for whoever either hacked it or, you know, rubber hosed their way into stealing the contents of that particular wallet.
Yeah, I saw some other news too about some guy being home invaded and had a gunpoint to his head and forced to do a transfer. I think that was in England. So yeah, it's a dangerous time to be holding cryptocurrency. Oh, and we got the world's best ICO here, Adam, and this one's been doing the rounds on Twitter. I mean, you'd call it a scam ICO, but they only made $11. But you know, it's Ethereum startup vanishes after seemingly making $11, leaves message penis. Adam, please tell us about this story.
Well, that's pretty much. I think you did not bury the lead at all there. That is exactly what happened. They had a startup that was supposed to like track vegetables on the blockchain, you know, for like figuring out what was grown where, you know, for food supply chain security or whatever. And yeah, they got funded to the tune of $11 through their ICO, and they appear to have run off with said $11, and yeah, replaced the entire contents of their otherwise very slick web page with the word penis. So
there you go. I hope they are spending their $11 wisely, right?
So yeah, buy an ice cream.
Yeah. Oh, YouTube visitors are having to deal with having like, you know, cryptocurrency miners dropped on them through JavaScript, which is just, I mean, what the hell? I mean, we were just saying how good Google is at security, and then you hear about this. You're like, yeah, God, how is that possible?
Yeah, well, maybe this is the first thing they should do is just go fix it so that you don't get crypto mined on YouTube. I gather they have already fixed this particular rash, but it's just not a thing that can happen, Google. Please just make that stop.
Yeah. So, yay. If you wondered why your YouTube tabs were getting a little bit excitable, that's probably why. And Facebook, meanwhile, last cryptocurrency story, I swear, Facebook has banned ads for ICOs and Bitcoin investment like completely from its platform, which I think is an interesting turning point, actually.
Yeah, that's a pretty stern message that you are in an industry that we all think is rubbish and is a scam and you should all stop and go and get real jobs. So yeah, hopefully that will stop some people who hang out on Facebook getting scammed.
Yeah. Now, Brian over at Krebs on Security has actually got a good write-up about some news that's been doing the rounds over the last week about so-called jackpotting attacks in the United States against ATMs. He's discovered that these attacks had already started happening late last year, so they're not strictly new, but we are seeing crews now actually going full Barnaby Jack against ATMs, and that's, you know, there's a part of me that just goes, that's awesome. Yay, Barnes.
Well, it's kind of, I mean, from a technical point of view, it's quite interesting to see that weaponized, I guess, in a way that can be used by your average, you know, ATM jackpotting criminal. In this case, the thing that was interesting, I thought, was that they're not actually doing, like, network attacks on the ATMs. They're actually going in, physically opening the ATMs, pulling the disk out, infecting it with some malware that knows how to interact with the cash dispensing hardware, plugging it back in again, and then waiting for some accomplice on the internet who gets a callback from whatever malware it is to then, you know, spit the cash out and then they can collect it and leave again, which is, you know, Barnes at least did it remotely over the network, which is...
Oh, he did, but I mean, his most impressive attacks were actually just plugging into the USB because they have a fairly standard key, a lot of these models, where you can just open up a panel which gets you access, not to the hopper or the cache, but you can open up the sort of service panel, drop some malware on it, and then off you go, right? So this is what he highlighted as being the most realistic threat.
Yeah, and I think, well, obviously the fact that it's being done in the wild suggests that, yes, it is indeed realistic. And I gather that part of the rationale here is that the people who service the, like, cash handling portion of the machine are often a different company than the people who service the software and the computer components, and so they have different levels of access control. You know, so the people who are filling the cash machine have different locks and a more robust kind of safe inside the ATMs, whereas the software, yeah, you can get to with a rubbish... you know, rubbish key that's the same on every Diebold ATM or whatever, and help yourself to the computer and then, you know, job done.
We've got a report here from CyberScoop that that I only really highlighted because it's talking about stuff that we spoke to Dan Gear about on the show. It was either last year or the year before, which is talking about what the impact to the US economy could be if a major cloud provider got shut down. And it makes for pretty sobering reading.
Yeah, the numbers are pretty significant. I think they said, what, like $15 billion worth of damage to the U.S. economy for, you know, an outage of one of the three big providers, like Amazon, Google, or Microsoft or something.
And over a period of a few days, which is, over, yeah.
And that's what I thought was interesting, was that they were talking about an extreme incident being 3 to 6 days and a very extreme incident being 6 to 11. And I'm looking at it going, wow, you're like, you're going to recover that quickly? I don't think so. Like, that's a... You know, what are you, you know, extreme, in my mind, extreme is probably going to be, well, what are you going to do if it's broken for 6 months?
Yeah, and I mean, it could be a number of things that could damage capacity. You know, I mean, you could be talking about earthquakes, damage to electrical infrastructure. There's so many things, floods, tsunamis, who knows, right? Like, I'm sure there's a lot of planning and a lot of risk modeling that goes into this stuff. But, you know, I think we need to reinforce that that's perhaps appropriate.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? And then also, I mean, there is a difference between risks like earthquakes and tsunamis and things. And then there's, you know, actual malicious humans that want to wreck things. And those are quite different. And I'm sure that, you know, Google and Microsoft and Amazon, you know, are capable of doing threat modeling properly. But, you know, there's plenty of people who are, you know, I guess next tier providers who maybe don't really think through or drill and exercise what it means to have a malicious adversary versus, you know, just your average act of God.
Mm. Now we're going to talk about a man who loves a challenge. Bob Lord is the new chief security officer for the Democratic National Committee, which is, you know, I mean, he's previously been at Yahoo and Twitter, and now he's at the DNC. So, you know, Bob certainly loves a challenge.
Yep. Well, you know, I guess he's had some experience with nation state adversaries, which may come in handy in his new role. So, you know, good luck to you. You've got a lot to do. I imagine the DNC will be getting a lot of attention in the upcoming midterms.
Yeah, well, I hope to be getting Bob onto the show at some point to talk about what his priorities are going to be in that role. And best of luck to you, Bob. Oh, now we've got a technical piece here, Adam, that you wanted to speak about, which is talking about a Active Directory attack technique called DC Shadow. What is this all about?
So this is some work by Ben Delpy, the developer of Mimikatz, another guy, Vincent Letou, they presented at the conference recently, called DC Shadow. It's a kind of a post-intrusion Windows Active Directory technique for like injecting attacker-controlled objects into the Active Directory database. So like sort of the replication process, but in reverse to what's currently implemented. So there's a really good write-up of this, you know, the way that this works and the way they've implemented it. That's totally worth a read for anyone, you know, on either the blue or the red team side of a Windows network. It's in particular been implemented into Mimikatz, so you probably will see attackers trying to use it, even though it's a pretty intrusive technique, and I don't know that I would be quite gung-ho enough to use it in the wild without really, you know, being forced to, I think. But yeah, certainly worth a read for anyone who's interested in AD internals.
Excellent. Now it's on to No Biscuit time, and Cisco has just issued a patch for a bug that earns a, you know, a 10 out of 10 on CVSS, which is, and this is affecting like their ASA devices, right? And this is like, it's a straight up horrible bug that if you're running Cisco VPNs, like you're going to get owned.
Yeah, this is pretty bad. Like, I think it's one of these bugs that's worth a 10 out of 10 on the CVSS rating. It looks like, I don't know if we've seen a specific like exploit code for it yet. I gather the bug is like a memory corruption, like a user after free or something in the XML parser of the kind of web VPN endpoint. So the SSL VPN component of the Cisco ASA, which is great because that's a thing that by design you expose to the internet on your security control point.
It's it's giving me flashbacks, this one. It's like old school, straight up, you know, fling a packet at it, get shells.
Yeah, I mean, remote memory corruption against the network security device is, you know, that's a sweet, sweet bug to have. And yeah, bad Cisco, very, very much No Biscuit. I don't know. It's going to be bad. Like, this is a bad thing.
Please, yeah, and I don't know that everyone gets the patches, right? Like, if you don't have support on them, do you get them? Like,
Cisco have always been kind of jerks about this. And yeah, if you don't have a current support contract, then you're probably screwed. If you do, I gather you still got to go talk to Cisco TAC and get one. And that's just a painful. Like, everything about Cisco support is painful, and this is, yeah, there's going to be a lot of unpatched stuff for a long time because of that kind of, you know, obtuse approach that that Cisco take to letting you have patches.
I mean, we don't really do huge focus on bugs on this show, but you would have to say that this should be priority number one this week for a CISO, right, is to figure out if they're exposed to this, because, oh, my God.
Yeah, like, this is a particularly bad bug because of the access that you get. Like, A, it's exposed to the internet, so likelihood's reasonably high. But B, once you're in, you're on a security control point. So you can steal creds, right? If it's AD integrated or integrated with other auth source, you can steal the creds. Obviously, access onto the network. If you've got complicated networks, you can probably tag stuff onto other VLANs or, you know, into MPLS or, you know, circumvent the other network security segregation controls, I guess is what I'm saying. And that's just, from an attacker point of view, is a winner. It's a one-stop shop to own the entire place, which, you know, good times.
Yeah. Also, Also in the no biscuit stakes, Oracle patched 10 exploitable vulnerabilities in VirtualBox, which is their hypervisor. Yay!
Yeah, guest to host, and some of them are like unproved users in the guest up to host, which is bad. So yeah, if you're using VirtualBox for stuff, and I guess we see it a lot used in sandboxes and stuff for malware, you know, investigation and that kind of thing. And that's kind of place where you probably don't want to be running an unpatched one, given that there are exploits available, and some of them are not too complicated as guests to hosts go. So yeah, definitely patch your VirtualBox.
Well, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun, and we'll chat to you again next week.
Yeah, it was good times. Talk to you next week, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Okay, it's time for this week's feature interview now, inspired by an article written by Liana Baker at Reuters. I've linked through to the piece in this week's show notes, and yeah, you know, it's you might want to check it out and have a read. It basically points out that a lot of money has been pouring into InfoSec startups, but things on the exit side have been somewhat underwhelming. Many security startups have become corporate zombies with little prospect of fetching a good price in an IPO or becoming acquisition targets, the story says. Now, my go-to person when I see news like this is Kelly Shortridge. These days, Kelly is a product manager at Security Scorecard, but she started her career as an investment banker doing capital raises and mergers and acquisitions for InfoSec companies. So when I read this report, I asked her if she thought the story was accurate. And as it turns out, she recently presented at B-Sides New York City about this very issue. She joined me for this interview, and I started off by asking her if she agrees that InfoSec investments have gotten, well, a little bit weird. Here's what she had to say.
That's completely my understanding. I would probably use a word stronger than weird. I think it's probably absolutely insane. The data doesn't really match up with logic, in my opinion. And yeah, I mean, there are a ton of problems. I'm happy to go into any of them, but the zombie thing is very real based on the data that I'm seeing.
Well, I mean, let's talk about those problems first. And then, you know, then I'm going to ask you to do what everyone loves to do in this area, which is to speculate on what might happen next. But it certainly feels like the craziness is accelerating. But why don't you walk us through the problems with the landscape as you see it, as you see them?
Sure. So I think a main problem is that very few startups actually focus on what are the real customer problems. In fact, I would say a lot of them are making up problems that customers don't actually have. So one kind of sniff test that I always propose is you have to be able to answer what next. So as an example, maybe you get a dark web intel feed. You can see that your passwords are available through some shady person. But the question is, what next? Something like two-factor answers that what next. So to me, two-factor is a much stronger category than something like threat intel. It's what can you actually do with this? And that, to me, presents a problem when most of the startups being funded are in and around detection. Like, there are obviously exceptions, but for the most part, it's detection. It's detection, but machine learning, detection, but AI, probably soon detection, but blockchain, which is very annoying. But there is a good analogy by Alvaro Videla, where he talked about how Uruguay came to have this super fancy radar for their Air Force. And when they turned this radar on, they saw that a bunch of planes were making drug runs over their airspace. The problem was they didn't actually have fast enough planes to catch them. So it's like, great, you can see that something's going on, but you can't actually do anything about it. And I would say most of the products that are being funded are like that. You can't actually improve your monitoring if you can't do anything about it. And the companies that are letting you do something about it tend not to get the most funding.
So it really sounds like one of the things that you feel is the biggest problem right now is just the simple fact that the wrong stuff is getting funded.
That's part of it. I think you can make an argument, for example, endpoint detection and response, what Gartner calls EDR, something reasonably that maybe some people need. It really depends on your threat model. The problem also is that some areas are getting overfunded. So, for example, it's maybe a $600 million market revenue-wise at the current state, but it received $500 million in funding in 2017 alone, which is a huge mismatch. And total, just among the companies that were also funded this year, it's something like more than $1.1 billion has been poured into it VC funding-wise. So basically, double the size of the market has been put into investments. Fact of the matter is we don't need 12 different EDR startups. The same thing happened with security analytics. That's a maybe $200 million market, but it's had over $500 million in funding. CASB, which was Cloud Access Security Brokers. I think we've probably seen the last of the major acquisitions there, but it was something, again, like a $200 million market, but over $500 million in funding. There are some decent exits, but really you don't need so many startups at once. And I can get into why VCs might be overfunding these areas and why they're gravitating towards bigger rounds.
But. Well, I mean, I just want to push back on one thing, which is when you say that EDR is a $600 million a year industry. I mean, I think EDR to a degree is a value add on the AV that gets bundled with it, right? So the revenue potential for the EDR companies is a lot higher than $600 million a year, wouldn't you say?
As I mentioned to you, I've been in this industry from a finance perspective for about 5 years now. And even when I first got in, EDR was supposed to be the AV killer and replace AV, but that hasn't materialized. So I'm very skeptical about that. An interesting problem why I think we see some overfunding, or what I would call overfunding, there are two key components. One is the fact that the VC, essentially the VC revenue model has changed. So it used to be that they would get carry. So basically when an investment did very well, they would make money off that investment. But in recent years, because VC, you know, think about Ubers and so forth, more people have been wanting to invest in VC funds. They now have been able, when they raise these new funds, to make an agreement where they actually get management fees that are based on the total fund size. And one way to convince limited partners, the LPs, which invest in the VC funds, to invest in bigger funds is by investing in bigger rounds and bigger companies. So if you invest, you know, $1 billion in 1 year, you can justify, hey, we need to raise a $5 billion fund. You know, you say get 2% of that, you're living a pretty nice life. So that's, I think, part of the reason why we see some really big rounds for companies that don't necessarily need them. The other thing is, based on the data for 2017.
So hang on, just to clarify that, what you're saying is the entire incentive model for the VCs themselves has changed.
Correct. It doesn't matter as much as far as what goes into their pockets on how well a company does. It's more about how much funding can we give them.
So they're making their money on the input, not the output these days.
Correct. Yes.
What and could of go course, wrong?
Right. And it, from people with whom I've spoken who have been in the industry for a while, it goes back and forth. Basically, the same thing happened in the dot-com days, apparently. Like, it just goes in cycles. It's the same thing for private equity as well. So I'm sure there will be a correction at some point, but it has manifested in very large startups being funded that probably shouldn't be very large startups.
So we've seen an awful lot of money pumped in and not an awful lot of money come out thus far. And I think, you know, a lot of people are searching for that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. So they'll build up one company in one category, which will be, you know, hot for about 10 minutes. And then its share price just goes onto that zombie tailspin. Something's got to give, right? Either the, you know, I mean, what's going to happen here?
It's a good question. So based on the data I have, there's about one company. So for startups founded in a given year, there's about one company per year that exits over 100 million. But just in 2017, over 30 startups were valued at over 100 million. So there's clearly an imbalance. At some point, that does have to correct. We saw a few deals last year. There was one in security analytics where there was essentially a down round where the last valuation that the company had funding-wise was actually higher than their eventual M&A exit. And I think that'll happen a few different times. It's certainly not going to be through IPOs. There were three IPOs last year, Okta, Forescout, and SailPoint. Okta was really, when we think about kind of traditional VC-backed, you know, unicorn types, that's really the only one. So that pipeline isn't there. I think people are betting, or VCs are really betting on M&A markets. I'm incredibly skeptical about that. In 2014, when I was creating pitch books around this, the median multiple was, I think, 14 times revenue. Now it's around 5.5. So it's even harder now to get those huge, huge valuations. I think if I were investing, the smarter strategy is to play at the early stage. You know that you can probably, you fund a hot category. Let's say CASB, for example, there were some really, really solid exits in that category even this year. So you fund a startup, make sure they don't raise too much money. Their tech is just as good as whoever the market leader is, the one who's raising all this money, spending on sales and marketing, teaching the market, blah, blah, blah. You're the less expensive option, right? Instead of them buying the Ferrari, you know, you're the, I don't know, whatever, a Porsche, let's say. So you're still pretty good. And frankly, the fact of the matter is when acquirers are looking at these security startups, a lot of times it is mostly technology. They do want to see some customers just to make sure that the product market fit is proven out. But for example, Cisco, you can't compete with their sales engine. They're going to push the technology through sales engine.
So. Well, I've always said that Cisco could all of a sudden become a fresh fruit company and still do just as well, because they're basically a really well-oiled sales and marketing machine first and a technology company second.
Exactly. So, you know, when you start to be worth $1 billion as a security company and you have a competitor that's raised, let's say, $20 million and was last valued at $100 million, do you think, and the technology is basically equivalent, do you think they're going to buy you for $1 billion or be able to not even have to disclose the purchase price because of, you know, to Cisco, $100 million is like buying a Coke Zero for us?
Chump change. So look, what are the categories that you think might survive? I mean, because look, it seems the logical conclusion of what you're saying is eventually there's going to be some sort of compression. And I'm guessing that's going to be kicked off when money, maybe the rate of money flowing into InfoSec startups slows down. You know, companies with maybe not so great revenues are going to have to start laying off and just sort of scaling down a bit. And then there's a round of mergers and acquisitions at pretty awful valuations. And then, you know, then we enter a new environment. But what are the categories? First of all, do you agree that that's probably what will happen? And second of all, what are the categories that you think will survive the best?
I think we still probably have maybe a year or two of this sort of environment or this sort of dynamic. Another stat that I found from last year, 52% of startups were funded by what I call one-off investors. So that means that was the only deal that they made in security for the whole year. And this was funding rounds led. So basically people who are not experts in the space are leading rounds and sometimes big rounds in this space. So I think you have a lot of headlines. Obviously people see things like Equifax or now Spectre and Meltdown. And so they're like, oh, we have to make, you know, with in air quotes, a security play. And so, you know, something sounds fancy, they use the right words, you know, threat, thwart, actionable insights, intelligence, blah, blah, blah. So they think it sounds really cool and they fund it. And I think you'll see that probably for another year or two because those investors haven't been burned as much yet. I think categories all exist. One analogy I like to give is that I think a lot of funding right now is going to the 1% problems, or what I call like the juiceros of security. For example, like their threat models, basically they're addressing are what I would call Mossad problems rather than the problem that normally exists, which is, you know, this company doesn't have enough resources to cover the basics. So I think companies that are covering the basics in a meaningful way and helping workflows will continue to survive. They'll find exits. They'll be able to find customers. But companies that are relying on the fact that, you know, AI or deep learning are the sexy terms of the moment, and really it's just detection plus, and they're basically feature enhancements, I don't think they're going to survive.
I am seeing companies actually move in that direction, though. You know, some of the smarter ones like Rapid7 and Exabeam are both putting a lot of work into workflow stuff around SIEMs and incident response, right? Just simple workflow templates for people because, you know, finding people who actually know how to perform these steps is pretty hard. So they're trying to, you know, help them automate and tell them what to do.
Exactly. I think any company, or if I were starting my own security startup right now, I would focus very heavily on UX. And to date, I think most security startups have ignored that. And I think that's, I shouldn't say I think, because I don't actually think it's going to change anytime soon, but I would hope, you know, successes like Duo Security, which I think by any measure is a success right now. The fact that if you can make users happy, you will be able to sell products. I think that's hopefully a meaningful example for the kind of like InfoSec startup community.
Yeah. Now, look, I mean, it wouldn't be right for me to have you on the show and not ask you about Google's announcement today. I know it's just dropped, but I wanted to get your gut reaction on this, because this, to me, this announcement by Google that they've started this new company and they're bundling VirusTotal into it, and, you know, with the visibility they've got into badness on the internet and with the smart people they've got internally who are already rolling out usable security technology within Google, and now they're going to start offering some of that goodness to the outside world. I mean, that to me looks like a fireball headed for Planet Threat Intel, or at least it has the potential to be a fireball headed towards the Planet Threat Intel. What's your take on that?
I'd agree. I haven't dug into it too deeply, but I think any company, you know, the problem with security analytics and threat intelligence is fundamentally, again, it's a 1% problem. Most companies they haven't built the foundation yet to be able to use those technologies. If Google can find a way, and given their track record, they probably can. They can find a way for the 99% to be able to use those sorts of like threat intel feeds or analytics in a way that doesn't just add a bunch of work and requires more people. I think they'll be successful, because right now the problem with threat intel and why I think they've successfully gotten a lot of funding is they're able to get a lot of fancy logos because fancy companies, security-wise, can actually use threat intel feeds. But if you think about, you know, a typical, you know, credit union or let's say even hospital, a lot of times
they spruik their Fortune 100 customers, right? Like that makes a lot of sense to me. Whereas Google, it's like, yeah, anyone can use it.
Exactly. So if Google is able to, crack that nut, so to speak, I think that they would be incredibly successful. And yeah, I would in some ways hope it's a fireball, because I'm tired of seeing week after week more threat intel companies being funded. So
you're just mean, Kelly. You're just mean. All right, Kelly Shortridge, thank you very much for joining us on the show to share your thoughts about what's happening in the on the investment side in InfoSec at the moment. And, my personal feeling is that you're right and that this probably won't continue indefinitely. So, yeah, thanks again for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Kelly Shortridge there. Big thanks to her for that. It's time for this week's sponsor interview now with Jordan Wright of Duo Security. And as you heard in our feature interview, everyone loves Duo. I'm actually a bit of a Duo Security fanboy. And please don't get that confused with being a paid endorsement. If you listen carefully to this show, you'll know that we don't actually endorse the sponsors as part of some sort of sponsorship agreement. Most of the time, you know, honestly, I don't know enough about the real world uses of many of the sponsors' products to know if what they're offering is something fantastic. That's up to you to figure out there in tech buyers land. But some sponsors I do know enough about to be a fan of. And in the case of Duo, they're best known as being a multi-factor authentication company, but really, in my view, they're more than that, in that they're positioning themselves as the Beyond Corp for the rest of us company, with a heavy focus on, you know, helping people to build zero trust networks. And so I'm a genuine fan. They really get it, and they have a great plan, which is not something you can say, sadly, for every security company. Anyway, this week we are talking to Duo's very own senior research and development engineer, Jordan Wright. He's been doing a deep dive on phishing kits, which, you know, is a topic that's been done. But what makes this worth talking about is they've done a pretty comprehensive job with this research, pulling down thousands of kits, which is enough of a scale to draw out some interesting stats and data points. I've linked through to Jordan's report in this week's show notes. But anyway, here's Jordan Wright of Duo Security talking about phishing kits, what the tilt towards HTTPS-enabled phishing kits means, and what the future might hold for the U2F authentication standard. Here's Jordan.
Yeah, so whenever we started taking a look at this ecosystem, we started realizing two things. The first is that our methodology around how to find phishing kits was really effective. We have found at the time of the paper being published, we had just over 3,200 kits. And I just checked this morning and we're getting close to 10,000 unique phishing kits currently in our collection using our automated scrapers. Now, whenever we look at phishing kits and trying to figure out what purpose do they serve and how effective are they, we're finding that they're being used really, really frequently. So that 10,000 unique kits is just a sign that this problem is only growing. Attackers are continuing to leverage phishing kits because they are a very reusable, low-cost solution to try to send out as many phishing emails as possible.
Well, and you'd think too that if you're turning up 10,000 sites or 10,000 kits, that attackers are using automation, right?
It's quite possible. Yes, absolutely. We are seeing signs of similar deployments, meaning maybe the paths to the phishing site are the same with the same phishing kit. You know, other signs like that. They're definitely, at least the code itself is being reused at a high rate.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that was one thing that you looked at in this is, you know, commonalities between kits. I mean, quite often when we look at things like, I remember I did an interview with some with Proofpoint last year, and, you know, they have visibility into an awful lot of email. And they said when you really drill down into it, there's you know, the ownership of spam botnets is surprisingly concentrated. You know, there's like, you know, you knock out the 10 most prolific people and you're taking care of an awful chunk of the problem. Is it similar with phishing kits as well? Are there like a handful of crews and you can say, well, geez, there's 5,000 of those kits are being sort of, or sites are being run by one person?
It's hard to tell if... you know, we definitely saw quite a few email addresses tied to where the credentials, the stolen credentials, are being sent. But what's really neat about phishing kits is that since you have the server-side code itself, you get two pieces of information. One is where the stolen credentials are being sent, and the other is kind of a calling card for whoever made the phishing kit. So what they'll do is, in the from header, the email containing the stolen credentials, this from header will contain an email address purportedly belonging to the person who created the phishing kit. And so by taking these two pieces of information, we can create a map showing how actors or how particular email addresses are tied to different kits and how those kits are tied to different sites. And so we can really quickly find those clusters showing one calling card as an example, one person creating kits are tied to all of these different unique phishing kits, which are then used by all of these different exfiltration points. It's hard to tell, since it is just an email address, if it's one actor in control of all those email addresses. But in terms of where the kits are being created, we are seeing those bits of code being reused from just a few sources. Yes.
It's interesting, right? Because you're right. You know, a phishing kit is easily replicable and quite simple. So it's not like you're going to get the same level of cross attribution that you're going to get by looking at malware, which is, you know, compiled code and a bit fiddlier.
Right. And what's interesting is we're seeing different bits and pieces from various phishing kits being kind of combined into one. So an example would be, maybe a phishing kit uses the source files, you know, the cloned website from one phishing kit, and then it uses the mailing aspect to actually send credentials from a separate phishing kit. And maybe it would also include anti-bot measures. So what we would call persistence measures, which is typically a PHP script or an htaccess file that's sole job is to make it harder to detect that phishing site. So it'll block IP address ranges from cloud server providers. It'll block IP address ranges from people like VirusTotal, FishTank, making it difficult for researchers to verify that this is a phishing site if they're coming from one of those security vendors. And yeah. So they'll take all these different bits and pieces and merge them together into their own kind of custom phishing kit.
Now, it was nice to see one hard stat in this research that is really good to put a number on, and that's that 16% of phishing websites that you looked at are actually using HTTPS, presumably from services such as Let's Encrypt, which, you know, we've spoken about this on the show a bunch. I mean, we've really invalidated that advice that we've been giving for 20 years that users should look for the padlock to know that a site is legit. What substitute advice can people listening to this, you know, who are security people, I'm sure their family, their friends, they ask them, hey, what, you know, what should I do to make sure I'm safe online? What advice would you give them?
Absolutely. So you're right. It is important to take a step back as a security community and think critically about the advice that we're giving and how effective that is at scale. You know, how trustworthy is it just to tell people, just look for HTTPS? Because as you mentioned, you know, our paper shows that phishing sites are starting to use HTTPS at an increasing rate. And so as substitute advice, something that I've always offered to users is to use a password manager. This has the benefit where the credentials are tied to the domain, to that specific website that they saved. And so if they're on a phishing site, they can't give up their credentials because on one hand, ideally, they wouldn't know what that password is. It was generated uniquely for that website. And on the other side, the extension knows this isn't the correct site. You know, I'm not going to give up these credentials because this is not what I expect it to be, barring some kind of vulnerability in the password manager, which is usually pretty rare and fixed pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's funny that one, right? Because, there's a lot of noise made about password managers, vulnerabilities in them from various quarters. But, if it stops users from accidentally entering their creds into the wrong site, I mean, that's a good thing, right? You'd think that would outweigh the risk from, zero day.
Always, absolutely. So there was the timing of our report was really coincidental because it came out in tandem with a separate, completely independent paper from Google called Data Breaches, Phishing, or Malware, Understanding the Risks of Stolen Credentials, where they took a different approach looking at the credentials that are stolen from places like malware and phishing. And so what they found was, on average, the phishing kits that they came across were stealing roughly 230,000 potentially valid credentials every week. And so if you compare that with a number of people who are affected by a vulnerability in a password manager, it's really not even close. The number of people getting affected by phishing greatly outweighs the number of people who would ever be affected by a vulnerability in one of those password managing extensions for the short while that it's available.
Now, it's all, it is great to use a password manager to tie those credentials to that site. I mean, it's, it's not a perfect solution, but it's, for most users, it's a good one. And it's sort of similar to U2F in that if you're using a U2F token for authentication, it knows to only authenticate to the actual correct domain. And that's all, crypto magic under the hood that does that. Before we started this interview, you and I were having a discussion and you were saying you believe that U2F is going to be the winning standard. And furthermore, that you expect hardware supporting U2F to eventually find its way into consumer products like laptops, desktops, and smartphones. Is that right?
That's the goal. We're starting to see an increased adoption in U2F from major service providers like Gmail, Facebook, Dropbox, and Duo has supported it for quite some time. And we're starting to see other protocols like WebAuthn coming out of FIDO, which is the organization creating and managing these standards. And so WebAuthn is kind of an overarching standard compared to U2F and UAF, but it all centers around the same thing. How can we use public and private key pairs tied to an origin, a domain, or a website to make that process of logging in much more secure? And so the hope is, right now, you're right. Authenticators are kind of considered a luxury whenever it comes to consumer access. You have to buy a separate piece of hardware in order to enroll and use these different standards. Hopefully, we're starting to see this roll out with different consumer products, but hopefully we'll start having some hardware-backed security chips enabled directly into consumer products themselves. The goal is that then you don't have to go out and buy something new. It's using what you already have, which provides the same strength for free. And so that's what will really drive the adoption of some of these standards. Because right now it's kind of a chicken and an egg problem. There's motivation to enable support from a standard whenever the most users can start using it. But users don't really have encouragement to go and buy one of these authenticators, which is a cost to them, if not many of their service providers support it. So it's kind of this catch-22 situation that it will really start making incredible strides whenever we start seeing the right kind of hardware being put directly in consumer devices themselves.
Yeah, well, I imagine it would be a fairly easy bolt-on for something like Apple's Secure Enclave processor. I think it's also, Apple could move on this a little bit easier than others because they control the full stack, right? I think with Google's, Pixel devices, it'd be something easy to implement. But once you start rolling it out across different manufacturers and there's integration issues between the software and the hardware, that could slow it down. But I mean, I would hope to see Apple at least perhaps introduce U2F capability into their Secure Enclave within a couple of releases. Would you expect that as well?
I hope so. It's always hard to tell what's going to be coming out in the next generation of these consumer devices. And I think it's a really good point to make where it is going to be easier to control the hardware going into devices whenever you control the full stack. And we have seen incredible strides from Apple and Google coming out with secure hardware like the SEP directly on the devices themselves. And it's interesting. We're starting to see people take advantage of that. For example, GitHub recently released a project called Soft U2F, which is a U2F client developed in software, which uses the SEP as a backend key store. And so that's kind of the capabilities that having secure hardware enables.
Now, regardless of whether or not we move towards this world in which every consumer has a hardware-backed U2F token, U2F capability in their pocket, I mean, that's where we all want to be. But we know, you and I both know, that this is going to be at least 5-10 years out, right? In the meantime, do you expect that the phishing ecosystem will just keep kicking the can down the road like it is now?
Absolutely. And the reason is, this is all a business. And so if I'm an attacker, my goal is to get as many credentials as I can for the lowest cost possible. And so phishing is the solution to that. If I can get hundreds of credentials by sending thousands of emails, that's still pennies on the dollar for me. And I'm making quite a large profit margin for minimal effort. So I do expect to see phishing continue in its current form.
All right, Jordan Wright, thank you very much for joining us on the show to walk us through your research on phishing, a research of some scale. And I've linked through to the report that you've written in this week's show notes. Thanks again.
Excellent. Thanks for having me, Patrick.
That was Jordan Wright of Duo Security there. Big thanks to him for that. If you run an enterprise network and you don't know much about Duo, please do yourself a favor and check them out. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.